This is the Freedom Fiends broadcasting from Pod Bay 2A, a mile above sea level at Intergalactic Prairie Studios. We alter your locus coeruleus by rejuvenating your brain by warming it to a tasty and toasty 325 degrees Fahrenheit. I am Mr. Michael Dean, the angry hamster. No, I'm the iron hamster, and we got Mr. Davi Barker. What's your animal wrestling name, sir?
I am the shiny badger.
Yep, and we got Mr. Hooked. Counselor, please weigh in. Who are you?
The Wampus Cat here from Jefferson City, Missouri in the Ozark Mountains.
Speak up, son. Get up on the mic, please.
And we need to be a little louder. How about that?
Yeah, that's better? Good. That's good.
Thank you.
Yep. The board op has the day off. He was eaten by a zombie. It was a politically correct zombie, and we'll be talking about that later. We're going to talk a bit about the TV show Better Call Saul. And you are an attorney, correct, there, Mr. Wampus Cat?
So they say.
Yeah.
The sheepskin on my wall.
And you are a former prosecutor. What did you think of the scene, the montage in episode 2? Okay, spoiler alert. And, you know, there's really no spoiler alerts anymore because the show in pop culture now, Davi's decided is stale after, what was it, 6 hours, Davi?
Six hours, yeah. That's the shelf life.
Yeah, and I do want to say, we're talking over Fiend Phone. We're using the Opus Music setting, and these guys sound really creamy, and they're at least 1,000 miles away from me each. Talk a little bit, both fellas.
Please. How's it going? This is me sending my voice over the airwaves.
Yes, and right here, coming out at the highest possible quality that can be generated by Fiend Phone. Is that right, Michael?
Yep.
We got Missouri, Wyoming, and I'm California. So
there you go.
We'll talk
to
you.
That's some big distances.
We'll talk to you anyway.
Yeah, I know. My name is Davi Barker, and I'm a Californian.
Hi, Davi. Yay.
Hey, you know, I do have my 10-year socialism chip, so that's pretty good.
You mean you've been a socialist for 10 years? No, I know that's not.
No, I have not touched socialism in 10 years.
But you've
Excellent.
Lived in California.
Although it touches me.
Well, it does. It does. Well, I've got a 5-year California anonymous chip. I've not set foot in that state for over 5 years, and I lived in the bellies of the beast. I lived in San Francisco for 16 years, and I lived in Los Angeles for about 10 or 12 years, something like that, from 86 to 2000 and, I don't know, 7, 8, something like that. I can't count, but yeah, I'm done. I don't have to do that anymore. California.
Well, I've at least admitted I have a problem.
California would be a great place if it weren't for all the Californians. I mean, that state has everything, man. It's got mountains, forests, beaches, deserts, cities, rural farming. It could be a nation with a big wall around it. And maybe they should put a big wall around it so everyone stays there. I'm kidding. I'm for freely open borders. Are you guys?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Oh, I like that. Except the borders of my yard.
There you go.
Are not always open.
Well, Randy and I are kind of like that. We're like, get off my lawn, you gosh darn kids. That's my attitude about politics to the world.
Yeah, I think it's sort of a strange superstition that people feel the need to put armed guards around imaginary lines.
Yeah. Well, government is a collective hallucination. And I'm vaping. I'm vaping vape from CryptoVape.net. Gotta say, really loving it. Inexpensive, and they love Bitcoin at CryptoVape.net. Okay, so Better Call Saul. Now, I had a suspension of disbelief question for Randy. In the amazing sequence in episode 2 where they show him doing all of his public defender work, is that how it works anywhere, that you kind of like just show up like it's, you know, like a job, like a temp job where he just
That was my favorite part of the whole show because it was so totally accurate.
Show up and like get the jobs for the day from the clerk?
No, that part is different in different places. Apparently there, the way they're portraying their public defender system is that attorneys in private practice can just get appointed by the court and then go get paid by the clerk, and you know, the clerk sends the appointments. Like in our state, we have full-time public defenders and only attorneys that want to do public defender work. Oh, and they had the pay scale right. He was getting $700 to do a felony. I used to get $750 to do one.
Well, this was earlier. When were you doing it? And it wasn't New Mexico, because this is New Mexico, and this was probably supposed to be about 20 years ago, I think.
Oh, this would have been, 6 or 7, 8 years ago in Missouri. And, then it was at that point, the fee was $750 for a felony and half that for a misdemeanor.
Yeah.
And so that was pretty accurate. No, the thing that I really enjoyed, you know, the crazy thing where he'd meet the client and 10 seconds later they were running into court to do what they were doing. I mean, all of that.
Giving the guy his belt.
Well, you show up. Yeah, you show up there and you may have a whole bunch of clients that you have to deal with. So each one of them gets about 10 seconds. And, of course, that's with public defenders. Most of your private attorneys don't have the heavy, you know, the huge stack. I remember when I was a prosecutor and I'd go in there and I'd have these two huge files and there'd be 100 cases. And I would sort of daydream that someday I'll quit all this and then I'll have 100 cases and everyone will have paid me, you know, several thousand dollars for each case. And the part about the 100 cases never came true. So I walk into court, you know, with two or three under my arm or on a slow day one.
Where they showed him over and over and over talking with the prosecutor, and the prosecutor just saying, petty with the prior. As a private attorney who used to be a prosecutor, did that remind you of like fighting in your head or something?
No, that guy kind of reminded me of a jerk or two that I knew, but he's not non-existent.
So the scene where Saul hands him some corn chips and gets him to reduce his sentence, do you think that ever happens?
Well, it would all depend if the prosecutor was really close, you know,
really hungry.
Once you get into a gray area on the case, it may not take much to tip you over and say, okay, deal.
Wow.
You never know what'll do. It just depends on whether you're close or not. In that, I mean, you look at that, and in real life, that prosecutor was maybe mulling over in his head, well, should I do it? Shouldn't I do it? And the guy offers him the chips, and he goes, okay, we'll do it. You know,
could that be construed as a bribe? I'm just saying.
If it's under a dollar, it's not a bribe. Isn't that the law?
I don't know, but it was a kind of gesture. You know, getting more, usually honey is better than vinegar, right? You know, you treat the prosecutor decently, and he's liable to treat you that way.
So, Davi, what thoughts and questions do you have for our resident legal correspondent about Better Call Saul?
About the show?
Yeah.
Wow, I don't know. I guess, I mean, I want to get more into the series, but if we could sort of have an ongoing like legal accuracy check, I think that'd be interesting.
Yeah, well, I think everybody gets that him trying to set up, these crooked deals is probably.
I got one. So, is there any reason
the bar?
Is there any reason why these two kids with the broken legs wouldn't just cause hell for him? I can't imagine that they just went ahead and disappeared because he paid their medical bill.
They're terrified, man. I think they're really,
well,
really,
you know,
terrified.
They seem stupid enough that you'd have wondered if they'd have just disappeared, but maybe they figured out that if they ever contacted or had anything to do with him again, they could end up dead.
They probably also have had some brushes with the law over fraudulent accidents. You know, the law might, the police might know them and know who they are. And if they showed up with, broken legs and said, someone did this to me, the police might think they were running a scam and not investigating.
They're criminals, and so they have no recourse.
That's what I was going to say. That's the line.
That was the best line in the whole series for me so far, was the member of the drug gang or whatever. I don't even remember his name. The member of Tuco's gang who comes to Saul, and he says, I like to rob thieves because they're criminals and they have no recourse.
Yeah, and, you know, there's a classic thing in the hero's journey writing template where the hero early in the story, and this is an episodic thing, so end of episode two is early in the story, where the hero refuses the call, where the hero is called to do
he
what
refuses
the hero,
to call Saul.
Yeah. And but you can tell that it's leading up to Saul going from a slightly fraud, you know, a low level fraud ambulance chaser type to a criminal, to
Slick Jimmy or whatever it was,
to a criminal attorney, you know, but he's refusing the call. He's like, he's trying to be good. He's trying to say, no, man, I don't want to do that. I just want to be an attorney.
And it's a real call. It's a phone number. The guy says, call me when you realize you're already in the game.
In the game. Yeah.
Yeah, it was the same as Bilbo at the beginning of the, you know, The Hobbit, yeah. You know, yeah. I mean, they wanted him to go and he wouldn't go. You know, it is, you're right though. In the beginning of the show here, he's a lot more honest than he was. Even the thing, you know, with the scam with the woman, he wasn't trying to cheat her out of any money. He was just trying to get her business.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's also not Saul Goodman yet. He's Jimmy McGill or something.
He's always Jimmy McGill.
There's a reference to that in Breaking Bad. He says he's trying to impress somebody, and he says that he's Irish. And at the time, in Breaking Bad, I thought it was a story. Like, I thought he's not really Saul Goodman, and he's not really James McGill. That, like, who knows what his name is? But he says, you know, I'm a genuine potato eater, but, you know, these young brothers want a piping hot member of the tribe, like saying they want a Jewish attorney. So he changed his name to Saul Goodman. But
yeah, he's talking to Walter White, who comes in and gives a false name, and he says something like, are you English or Irish? And and he says, faith in Begorra, a fellow potato eater. And like Michael said, he says, I just, how was it? I just do the Jew thing for the homeboys. Yeah. He says.
Yep, that's what he says.
It was great.
I like that. I bet that was a joke when it was written. But I'll bet that the writers of this show know Breaking Bad so well that they did this on purpose.
Oh, of course.
Well, the writers
of Breaking said his
Bad,
name was McGill.
The creator of this show is Vince Gilligan, is the creator of Breaking Bad. I don't know if, I haven't checked to see if they have writers in common, but it definitely seems like it's having to expand backwards from what you already know about Breaking Bad. Randy says he likes it.
And then to
than
have
Breaking
the
Bad.
Other Hammond and McGill, to have the other law firm trying to get him to give up his own name. I mean, I'm already intrigued. I'm totally
the
impressed.
The Michael McKean character is amazing. The
The
crazy rich attorney who's afraid of cell phones. Yeah, I love that. That's the singer in Spinal Tap. You guys know that, right?
Yeah.
That actor?
Yeah. And Lenny from Laverne and Shirley, if you remember that.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. Go to freedomfiends.com to help keep it drone proof.
Are you tired of your taxes funding endless occupations around the world? Antiwar.com is run by people who understand that wars abroad become wars at home, wars on our freedoms. Antiwar.com is dedicated to bringing you the latest in news, views, interviews, and reviews from the top movers and shakers in the anti-occupation movement. Antiwar.com has it all, from thorough foreign policy analysis to interviews with whistleblowers who used to run the military-industrial complex. Anti-war, pro-free market. That's antiwar.com.
And if Michael's talking, his green line is real tall while he's talking, right? Because, you know, he's filling up most of that space. But while he talks, there's a small, you can see his voice coming over through the bottom of Davi's.
Davi's leaking. I heard some echo in that whole part.
Yes. And, and Davi,
Davi's
and
beard
when Davi
is stuck
talks,
in his headphones again.
You want to give me a minute of silence and let me see if I can figure it out?
Yeah, hang on a sec. Go ahead.
There's more.
Silence.
Davi's
silence.
Bleeding more than Michael.
Silence.
Hang on a second. Check. Check. Yeah, I hear an echo.
Check. Check. Are your headphones on really tight?
Yeah.
Hmm. Can you turn down?
I can turn the mic. Down.
No, don't turn your mic down. Turn your headphones down on Fiend Phone.
I didn't mean turn down the mic. I meant turn the mic.
Okay. Well, it's still going to be pointing at your headphones because they're on your head.
Yeah,
that's true.
So turn down your headphone slider. I'm recording, by the way. I'm the Libertarian NSA. Yeah, and to answer your question, Davi, I think for the new secret mission statement of the Fiends, I think during the breaks is the same rules as during the show. Because actually, like, the people listening on radio don't even know what we're talking about with that, but the people listening on the podcast do. So with our new secret mandate that cannot be discussed, and we have a secret here at Bavarian Gulch. So I'm getting too distorted when I get close. Okay, I'm further away. All right. Check. Check. I hear zero echo now.
That's better. Check. There's not much coming through on Davi's.
Davi, are you loud enough? Michael. Are we loud enough in your headphones now?
Yeah, I turned you down to about 70%, and it sounds okay to me.
Okay.
Now, let me ask you this. Is there any bleed over when I talk?
Go ahead.
Testing, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1.
Sounds good to me.
I don't hear anything.
Okay, so that's not coming through my headphones. I wanted to make sure, because Davi was doing it the most. Michael, just a little.
Yeah. Check, check. Go ahead and talk, somebody. Check, check.
Check. Check. I don't hear it.
All right.
I was kind of relieved to see these two episodes because I was really worried it was going to be sort of tongue in cheek and stupid and not a good spinoff. But it really feels like its own show already.
Mm-hmm.
It's great having Mike taking the tickets at the parking
garage. I'm just waiting. Like, that's how he met Mike. But you know, I'm really curious how they're going to tie Mike into his life. And Mike will probably refuse the call too at first.
I'll bet Mike's already involved.
In what? Oh,
whatever. I mean, there's criminals in and out of the court all the time, right? So I'll bet he's there for a reason. Like, I bet he picks up and drops off at the booth or something.
Yeah, because he's a former cop, and he's a private detective at some point, and it just seems like a job that's way below him. But there's also an implication given in Breaking Bad that he did something to become really disgraced in his job, like maybe he was kicked out of being a cop, or maybe was arrested, or who knows. Maybe that is the only job he can get. But he probably can't have a serious criminal record because he probably couldn't even work in the toll booth at the courthouse if you had a serious criminal record. Could you, Andy?
Yeah, that's good. You knew someone who could forge some documents.
Thinking that too. I'm thinking his name might not even be Mike. Mike Ehrman Trout.
I'm a little worried they're going to run into a Star Trek style Klingon problem where like people are going to know each other before they should know each other.
Here we go. So this is the Freedom Fiends. We're talking about Better Call Saul. So you have a fear, Davi. What is your fear about Better Call Saul?
Part of it is relief. So I was worried that Better Call Saul was going to be too campy and kitschy and funny and stupid, and it'd be too clearly an attempt to milk money out of the Breaking Bad franchise and not its own independent thing. And it is clearly an independent thing that is awesome in its own right. Which I'm relieved by, but I'm a little bit worried they're going to run into what I call the Klingon problem in Star Trek, and that is that by doing a prequel and introducing characters that meet before the start of the original series, you run into continuity problems.
You mean, right? Like, so, meeting Tuco at the very beginning?
Well, I mean, that might not be a problem yet, but that is sort of what I'm talking about. Like, how much can you develop the relationship between Tuco and Better Call Saul without contradicting something that's happened in the canon of Breaking Bad?
I think they probably have, if they're smart, and it seems like they are so far, they probably have as many continuity people on the team as they have writers. To make sure that doesn't happen. But
I bet they do. I bet they have.
Which is something I'd love to do, by the way. Yeah. I used to do continuity. It's one of my favorite things.
I'd be really bad at it.
So, like, in Star Trek, it was famous. It was Enterprise was the sort of prequel to the original Star Trek with Scott Bakula. And they just, like, introduced aliens in that show that had no business communicating with the Federation because they met in the original series. So they just screwed the timeline, you know what I mean? They had that problem in
Star Trek The Next Generation when you had Worf and the Klingons had the big bony foreheads and they really looked totally different. And then they had the episode where they had flashbacks or cut-ins from the original series, and
This is Deep Space Nine goes back in time to Trouble with Tribbles, right?
Wasn't Deep Space Nine, was it? It was one that Worf was in it, so it could have been Deep Space Nine. And they went back to that one, and somebody said said something to Worf to the extent of, what's with these weird-looking Klingons? And Worf had some some excuse, some story.
He just says, we don't like to talk about it. That's what he said. Yes, and you just, yes, as a fan, you just have to accept that. And it's like, I mean, that's a makeup problem.
It was good, though. It was good. You know, the line was perfect in it. They accepted the fact that everybody could see that this wasn't working, so he just says that.
The only real problem I have with the show so far, and it's minor, and I don't see how you'd get around it, is a slight need for a suspension of disbelief of the ages of the actors playing the people. Because this is supposed to be like 10 years at least before Breaking Bad, or maybe 5 years.
And Breaking Bad went for like 7 years,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. Like, let's say at best 5 years before Breaking Bad. Like, the guy playing Tuco is obviously like 42. He's not 35, you know, he's not 30 or 28, which he would have to be in this. And Saul has aged, and not terribly. Like, it's, you can kind of squint a little bit and it all works, but yeah, that's a slight problem. But
I'm willing to squint. It's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that doesn't bother me, because that's out of their control.
Yeah, they couldn't fix it.
I mean, the only thing they could fix it with is like really, really heavy prosthetic makeup, which would not be good, I think.
CGI.
There you go.
They did it in Tron.
All the actors would just wear like blue coverings on their heads, and they would just match points. Yeah. So yeah, I'm really, really happy with this show. I'm surprised too.
I'm ready to get over the Breaking Bad jokes though. Like, there's already been a couple of like Tuco says to his buddy, I think it's Nodos. He says, "Stop helping."
And you're like, yeah, and we all know how that ends. It's kind of interesting too, though. The other guy, the guy that goes and visits Saul, he's not in Breaking Bad. So I'd bet dollars to donuts right now, or, you know, Dogecoin to Bitcoin, that he's going to get killed. Because,
oh no, I think the opposite. I think Tuco is going to hand it off to him, and he's going to be our primary protagonist, and that's how they're going to solve the age problem.
When this goes into its seventh season.
Yeah, I think he's going to become a main character. The other reason why I really like that character is because he's clearly from this like Hispanic drug cartel, but he's not like the other characters we've seen in the cartel. He's not brazen, he's not flippant, he's not ignorant. He's a smart, calculating character, and I really like that element to the cartel.
Maybe he leaves and starts his own gang because he's too smart to be, you know, a henchman of Tuco.
Maybe he kills... No, he can't kill Tuco.
I'm wondering, too.
Was Tuco's grandmother in the original series?
No.
No, his grandfather was.
I thought she was great. She was so annoying.
She was such a wonderful actress for that. Now, I'm wondering if that's the wife of the guy that, you know, later becomes the main character, who's in Mexico at that point. Or is she the
woman in Vatos in Walking Dead?
We'll be back.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts.
Shiny badges on your jacket. Shiny badges.
This is Davi Barker from shinybadges.com, and I just want to personally apologize for airing a jingle week after week, month after month, that turned out to be such an infectious brain worm. So to make it up to you, I'm offering a free gift. The next time you make a purchase at shinybadges.com, write worms in the transaction comments, and I'll send you something weird.
No, wait, hang on a sec. Ask me again? I'm recording.
There's a Hispanic gang in Atlanta in the first season of Walking Dead, and there's a grandmother who calls the leader of that gang Mijo, which I'm sure is just like an honorific.
It means boy or nephew. It is an honorific.
Yeah. But it is an interesting dynamic because the same thing happens. Like, they're this like hard Hispanic gang and they're up against Rick and they're pointing guns at each other. And then the grandmother comes out and like dispels all the tension and invites Rick inside. And
it's not a uncommon trope, and it's not outside of the realm of reality of, you know, the tough vato who loves his grandmother or mother. It's also a common trope in cop shows of like the hard black gangster who just kind of like melts when his mother calls, you know, like the guy whose name is like Head Chopper or something, and his mother comes in and starts yelling at him when he gets arrested, like Aloysius, and all of a sudden he's not so hard, you know.
Yeah.
Head Chopper.
I like the reverse trope on the disrespect thing, that like there was this sort of like he disrespected my what is it, Amijo?
Grandma.
Yeah, or whatever. No. whatever it was. And so he's going to break these kids' legs just for like disrespecting his grandmother. But then the argument to not kill Saul is he's been showing respect.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I've never seen that side of the trope before.
I think that the, and the guy who says that is the smart guy. I think that the guy who says that is going to become, I think you're right, he's going to become a major player because he's got a head on his shoulders. And, you know, Tuco seems like he might have been smart about 20 pounds of meth ago. And Nodo seems about as smart as a houseplant.
I don't even, I remember them mentioning Nodos. I don't remember seeing Nodos.
Nodos gets killed.
He gets killed in Breaking Bad, doesn't he?
That's what
he?
I mean, yeah. Oh, you don't remember him in this show? There's four people out on the... There's three or four people out on the desert.
Oh, you're right. I'm thinking of... Badger's friend.
No.
Not Skinny Pete. There's Skinny Pete, Badger, and then there's the third one.
Who's Hispanic.
That's the Hispanic kid.
Badger. Isn't that Badger?
No, Badger's the white guy in the bank suit. The money costume.
Oh, the one who dies. Yeah. The one who sells him the meth mobile.
Yeah. But that wasn't Nodos, was it?
No.
What was his name?
Yeah, I don't remember.
I was looking for that kid. I was expecting him to be there.
I'll bet those guys will kind of cross in the periphery at some point. Like, you'll just see them walk by Saul when he's going into the nail salon. And Is the nail salon where his office is in the boiler room, is that the same nail salon that he later gets Jesse to buy or tries to get Jesse to buy as a money laundering front?
I think so.
Yeah.
I bet.
I think I remember.
It's either the same one or it's a callback to that because he did mention nail salons as a good reason because he's done it before kind of thing.
Although I think maybe they didn't use the same location because they just couldn't get the same location. It's a post office now or something. Because I think it was not the same location, but it was definitely the same type of... But although I don't know if it was the same nail salon, too, because there's an implication in the one that Jesse buys that they're doing sex work along with nail work, and this one doesn't have that vibe. Unless that's what his office is for yet. Yeah. Yeah, the Michael McKean character, man, the whole space blanket thing is... he's basically wearing a tinfoil hat on his body.
I do like that they managed to bring up that trope without saying tinfoil hat.
I know. Well, a millionaire, you know, could afford a closet full of space blankets.
Yeah.
He wouldn't need to make a tinfoil hat.
I wonder if gray matter exists in this world yet.
Ooh. Well, it would exist, but it may not cross paths. What are we going to talk
about? Wouldn't that be interesting if we, like, saw a young Walter White working at gray matter instead of being a teacher?
Yeah. I don't know how far back this is, if it's 5 years back, 10 years from... And I wonder if the last episode of it is going to, like, intersect with the first episode of Breaking Bad somehow.
I don't know.
We got 15
seconds.
Really clever. What do you guys want to talk about?
I like where we're going.
Well, you were...
Where are we going?
The,
I don't know where we're going.
The other topics we talked about were the writing topics.
Yeah, but let's stay on this. Point, right, we're back. Yeah. Freedom Fiends, and this is Mr. Michael Dean talking to Davy Barker and Randy England, and we got a couple of that's the Wampus Cat. We got a couple announcements. Let's see, and I was wrong. I said last night that William S. Burroughs said, "The insane have always loved me." Actually, that was Charles Bukowski, and I am very familiar with the differences between those two, but, you know, as I said during the break, I have a theory that the government is slowly drugging me with something in my vape or my milk or something to make me stupider. I said this like a year ago. I said, you know, I said this to Ben Stone on the phone like a year ago. You know, if the government were smart, they wouldn't kill activists. They wouldn't jail activists. The ones that are in front of a microphone all the time, they would just slowly make their IQ drop by like 50 points, so slowly that they don't notice it. But that, like, people who've listened to a long time, who tune out for a while and then tune back in, go like, man, Michael Dean and Adam Kokesh have gotten really stupid. What happened? You know, like, if we just got really dumb over a period of time on air, if everybody doing Liberty Media. And I said that as a joke like a year ago. Ben Stone recently announced he's more or less retiring from doing his podcast, and he's occasionally going to do The Fiends, but he's only going to do it when he's feeling really snappy and right on. And I'm starting to kind of like, it might just be that I'm getting older. I'm 50 now, but it might be, you know, just that, like last night in the middle of the first segment, I just lost my train of thought completely. So, yep, I think I'm getting stupider. And then
what if aging is a plot by the government?
I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
And then Davi was talking about the craft of editing and the craft of writing, and he was talking about how it's good. Like you can't look at a page you wrote and catch all the mistakes because you fill in your head what you meant. And he said to edit, you have to be a third person. And I think you meant second person, but maybe you were talking about the hamster in your brain. What was it?
I just meant another person. Like that's not even the correct place to use the expressions first person, second person, third person.
But you weren't using it that way. You weren't using it in intent or in person. You're using it as a third person, number three.
So I guess in my mind, there's always three people in my brain. And that is, I guess one of them is a hamster and he's the audience. And the other one is the critic and he's the editor. And then there is me trying to write a book while these two people yell at me about what they want.
Yeah, but you know what you were really doing when we say third person so much, we mean an outsider, right?
Yeah.
Somebody who's standing outside this thing. And yeah, you need that so much. You just can't see the things. If you wrote it once and it looked good, it's possible you could read it 50 times and it'll look fine every time.
And then, so yesterday's episode was called Libertarian Sociopathy, which is a takeoff on Davi's book, Authoritarian Sociopathy. And we were talking about the growing pain problem or just feature that liberty's having now, where it's becoming so popular that it's starting to attract just absolute insane people. And
a hiding place for foulness.
Yeah, and we're not talking about, you know, pundits or people whose names, you know, we're talking about just the new hamster audience that's coming in. And Davi made an incredible meme for it. It's for libertarian sociopathy. It's basically a kind of zombie looking Jason type character with a machete and a,
yeah, it's Jason Voorhees.
Yeah. With the hockey mask, but then with a Statue of Liberty crown at the top of it and a Davi Barker, libertarian voluntarist pin. I like that product placement. It was very good. And I actually got
I'm so libertarian, I root for the poltergeist because property rights.
I actually got a critical email. I got a critical email from some newly minted libertarian. You know, these people who like always take stuff too seriously. Like I've gotten like 20 comments from newly minted libertarians about our button, state speech is hate speech, or seen comments when people post the button. Like
they call you a social justice warrior.
Yeah. They say like, you shouldn't use the word hate speech. It's a government invention. And I'm like, come on, man, you don't get humor, obviously. But somebody who didn't get humor wrote me and said that we shouldn't have used the Statue of Liberty crown on it because that's not about real liberty. And I'm like, you're looking
at the point.
You're looking at this image for like accuracy. Okay, first of all, the guy's a sociopath. You think he's going to get all the iconography right? And then the second thing is like he also has a machete and a hockey mask. Do you think he's really on his way to play hockey?
So. Yeah, this is the thing. This is deliberate on my part. When I'm talking about a libertarian sociopath or people hiding in the liberty movement who are foul, they are often, this is a warning sign for me, that they're still using the Statue of Liberty iconography and the constitutionalist iconography, and they're mixing and matching their conspiracy theory with their libertarian rhetoric, and they're not centered. I'm looking for an uncentered person, right? And so it's deliberate that they're using the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah, that couple in Las Vegas that went and shot the police in a murder-suicide thing, you know, their Facebook page, whenever somebody does something crazy, I always go look for their Facebook page before it gets taken down. And their Facebook page, like, they'd clicked like on, you know, Adam versus the Man. They'd clicked like on Cop Block. They'd clicked like on, you know, Alex Jones. They'd also clicked like on a bunch of like the Patriots will rise again and constitution licking people, you know? So like they were kind of one from every column. They didn't really have any.
It's like if somebody tells me they're like a rigid Ron Paul constitutionalist and they support the Venus Project, like to me, that is an internal contradiction so deep that it's a red flag on that person for me. I'm not going to judge them right away, but it's like
you're not going to.
It's a warning sign.
You're not going to.
Now, are you sure
tea?
That they weren't using humor when they did it? I mean, the irony. You know, on my cover of my book, Free is Beautiful, I used the Statue of Liberty as an outline, and then filled the center of it with nothing but libertarian voluntarist memes. And maybe
you're crazy.
Oh, that's cool.
No, you're just speaking to the. There's actually on the Freedom Fiends blog. You know, you can on a WordPress blog, you can add all of your own not tags, but categories. And one of the categories I have on there is just speaking their language, which is for any post that's like kind of intended for people who are still in the left-right paradigm. You know, and I think that would put using the Statue of Liberty on the cover of a book about voluntarism would be definitely under the just speaking their language category.
Yeah. And that's the other thing. None of these things are like open and shut case. This person's crazy. They're just like these are the things that I look for when I'm trying to identify these people. OK. Yeah.
So, Michael, when you get one of these emails from the well-meaning newbie, do you handle them gently or do you slap them around?
It depends how much coffee I've had, how tired I am, how busy I am. I try to answer every email that I get at least the first time the person writes me. If they start getting really annoying, I will tell them to step back and tell them why they're being annoying. And if they're apologetic and try not to be annoying, I will still continue to interface with them. If they get offended, or sometimes if they're just crazy, I will just block them. It's really, people are not good at communicating a lot of times. And a lot of the emails I get are strangers sending me a link that says, look at this, read this, watch this. And I usually write them back and say, you know, there's no description. Like, they want me to waste my time and find out what it is. And it's often a 1 hour and 45 minute video about how the Federal Reserve is taking your money or something I already know.
Or it's a web page from 1997 giant letters in 50 different colors.
That's
really
crazy.
A favor to you because you know you don't need to even read the first word.
I can just tell they're crazy. Yeah, if there's flashing
crazy page,
flashing baloney. What I generally do with people these days is when they send me a link and say, "Look at this," I write them back and say, "My fee is $75 per hour, paid in advance," and they usually never write me again. It's weird because you can't tell what's going to make people your enemy. Like recently, one of these people that I would probably fit in this category of that we were talking about yesterday of libertarian sociopathy. It's a person who actually, like, I saw a thread later about that a bunch of people said that this guy is crazy. It was like he posted somewhere and said, "I need help with the audio on my podcast." And like five people tagged me on Facebook. Talk to Michael Dean, talk to Michael Dean, talk to Michael Dean. I'm the go-to guy for that. But as is often with this happens, I went on the thread. I said, "Give me a link to something you've done. He gave me this link. It was to a talkshoe.com or whatever Talkshoe Radio is, which is it's a site where people make horrible podcasts, where it automates making horrible podcasts, and then puts ads on them. Like basically, you don't even use a microphone. You call in on the telephone with you and another person and record a podcast, and it already sounds horrible. And then they like put it out at like 16K MP3, so it sounds even worse. And
how then, wonderfully democratic.
And then they put, anybody can do it. And then they put ads all over it. And so I said, well, the first thing you have to do is get a cheap, good mic and get rid of the TalkShoe thing and get your own domain and host on your own domain. And he started arguing with me, like, but I already have 100,000 listeners on TalkShoe. And I'm like, no, you don't. I would have heard of you if you did. And nobody on TalkShoe has any amount of listeners. And he was saying, I've already built my brand on somebody else's website. I can't leave. And I said, well, you should leave now before you actually get popular, because you don't want to build your brand on someone else's site. They could start charging $50 a day. You never know what they're going to do. They could go out of business. And he just started yelling at me. And I went, okay, I'm gone. And then like, this is the guy that yesterday or a couple days ago, like said he was kicking somebody out of the movement. And there was a whole thread about it.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, like this guy nobody's heard of is the decider of kicking people out of the movement. And that was where I came up with my line of, when I get kicked out of the liberty movement, do I have to turn in my gun and my shiny badges don't grant extra rights badge? And then all these people chimed in, like Neiman Vidotti was like, oh, I talked to this guy on the phone. He got my number somehow last year and called me up and like couldn't even talk. He sounded like a, you know, retarded 9-year-old or something. But the guy's like 35. So, yeah, that kind of thing, you know, like you never, like I was trying to help for free out of my busy day, someone I'd never heard of who just had a question about audio. and then they become my enemy. And like, this guy's talking about me behind my back, trying to like, you know, build up energy to hate me among other people. And, you know, there's a lot of that going on, and you really can't tell when somebody sends you a first email if they're going to be like that. And, yeah. And I get a lot of people contacting me. I also get a lot of people contacting me saying, you must interview so-and-so. And, you know, I kind of have a cut and paste now. Like, I basically used to say, like, well, we're not really an interview show, and here's a link to how to start a podcast. Why don't you start a podcast and interview them? And I think that people think that because we're on 35 stations now, as of today, as of this weekend, we'll be announcing that in the last quarter, because they're playing the best of that plays. So the last quarter of this will play on that show this weekend.
But I thought you announced it just now.
Yeah, but I didn't say what station yet, so I'm going to save it for...
Oh, well, whoever they are, welcome.
Yeah, welcome, but they're not going to hear this half hour. We got to do it in the last half hour of this show. So, yeah, but people are crazy, and, you know, sometimes, like, people think, you know, we need to interview so-and-so because we need to... Like, they think that we're CNN or something. They think that if we mention this problem and interview this person, the world will change overnight. We're not that popular, you know? We're
yet.
Popular. Yet. Yeah. Okay. People get mad, though, if I won't interview them or their friend.
I tell them... mad if you don't like the pages that they want you to like.
Yeah. Well, I mean, people I interview tend to die, too. I've interviewed a bunch of people who are dead, so...
The Freedom Fiends.
You don't want to be
that
interviewed
sounds
by
good
me.
For me.
Yeah.
Into your cerebellum.
This show survives on donations from fiends like you. We put that money back into our show and Liberty Outreach and donate most of our ad space to Liberty organizations that make a difference. We're also a teaching hospital, educating the next generation of Liberty talkers on the skills needed to keep the radio flame of truth burning into the future. Put your money where your heart is and make a donation of any amount to the Freedom Fiends. Please go to freedomfiends.com and click on the spinning coin on any post.
Wait, start this again. Start this again. What, okay, what about the crazy websites? I'm recording.
Well, the crazy website is the one that has the has all the
giant
crazy colors
and yellow.
Giant fonts. Then the
Dobby,
fonts
don't you
getting...
call that, isn't that called like ketchup and mustard web design?
Yeah, I call it ketchup and mustard.
Yeah.
It's called
it's
primary yellow. Colors, yeah. No gradients, no tints.
And you know the person is crazy, but there's a continuum, and it goes down, and you get fewer fonts, smaller fonts, fewer colors, gets down more. Pretty soon it just gets, you know, it's kind of colorful but not crazy, kind of like the Freedom Fiends, Fiend Phone site, that sort of thing, where it's not nutty. But it goes on further, though. You see the crazy one, and you go crazy, and you leave. You ever get to one where it's so plain and the font is so small, you go, too serious, I'm out of here.
Too long.
I mean, yeah, like JSTOR.
Yeah, there's a sweet
JSTOR?
Spot that you're willing to read, and you know, highbrow and lowbrow on each end. Leave me out of it.
JSTOR is an archive of like college educated peer reviewed
yes.
journals with no
yes.
pictures and all the same format and all the same.
I gotta find yeah. this.
I don't think you can access it without a student ID. Okay.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah.
Oh, I get JSTOR because I have a free subscription to Scribd.
Isn't it Scribd?
Well, in my experience, if you like tweet or Facebook, hey, does someone have JSTOR access that can send me this article, then it'll show up within a day. So
there you go.
The young conservatives site. I don't know, anything with an American flag on it makes me want to run away now. Although most
it's a
radio
bleeding American flag, for what it's worth,
is it? Most radio stations have an American flag on their website.
Are you saying that those colors are running?
What are they saying?
I have seen.
Look at them. They're running. Those colors are running in that.
I have seen people with stickers and t-shirts where they intentionally make the flag look like it's running. Like it looks like dripping wet paint, and they write on the sticker, these colors never run. And I'm like, you guys.
They're running.
You need an editor. That's what.
Now hold on.
Yeah,
I think they're just being ironic. Come on, give them a break.
I've seen these on. Well,
I would wear that.
This is Poe's Law all over again.
I would wear that as a joke.
I got to send
these
you guys.
These colors don't run. And on the back, it says, oops, well, maybe they do.
I got to send you guys this contract I got today from the radio station we're on. It's they printed out the GCN contract, and it's mostly black and white, but it's got one paragraph in red. And there was something about their fax machine or their printer or something. I think it was the printer that printed it out. Like,
is that the crazy paragraph?
No,
it's in big type.
It belched out a bunch of red ink, and there's red ink splattered down this whole 3 or 4 page contract. It looks like the poster for, like, I don't know, a slasher flick about lawyers or something.
I'd like to see it anyway.
The way it almost looks intentional, like a graphic artist intentionally splattered blood all over it this way. I'm sending it.
Obviously, it was meant to get your attention and succeeded.
No, I think their printer was just spewing out red ink, man.
The printer wanted to get your attention. Maybe it's trying to communicate.
All right, I sent it.
Its colors run anyway.
Its colors run.
It's your printer becoming sentient. It's trying to tell you, prick me and I do not bleed.
It arrived quickly.
Your printer's trying to be an editor. It's being editorial. You got it, Davy?
Do I have what now?
From check your Gmail email. To, yeah, check it. From Gmail to Gmail goes pretty fast.
Yeah. It's on the same network.
Oh, yeah. That looks like someone has been murdered on this agreement. No, not murdered. They were murdered, and then the body was dragged across this agreement.
Yeah. We're laughing because I got this contract in the mail today, the signed contract, and I guess whoever printed it out, their printer was spewing red ink, and it's this black and white 3 or 4 page contract that has just splattered bright red all the way down the middle of it. Like, and it doesn't even obscure the text. It looks like a crime scene. It looks like the poster for a slasher film about lawyers or something, because it's a contract just covered with blood, it looks like.
Oh, but, Michael, I've zoomed in on it a bit more, and this is not a wipe. This is a blood spatter.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Should I call the police in
we
that
We need to call
town?
A contract forensicist.
Looks like someone was someone, and it wasn't thrown from a knife. It looks like it was thrown from like a barbecue brush or something. Is that possible?
It's about the coolest looking contract I've ever, you know, I said when I was in a rock band and dealing with major labels and managers and stuff, I said, and this is the kind of stuff that I used to think was really deep, that I used to say in interviews on radio stations when we were on tour and in regional and national fanzines and magazines. And I'm kind of glad, like, you know, that stuff's out there. It's in like moldering piles of fanzines in people's garage. But I'm really glad that it wasn't on the internet to where, like, when you search my name, it's the first thing that comes up. Because one of the things I said back then, and this is one of the minor stupid things I said, not one of the major ones, but I said, and I thought I was being really deep. I used to like to say, man, if it was required by law that all contracts had to be written and signed in crayon, the world would be a better place. Like, I just thought that would make people not take things so seriously and be nicer to each other. I
don't even get it. What does that mean?
It made sense on a lot of drugs, man. I don't know.
If all contracts were signed in crayon, they would still be valid.
I think it's kind of like saying when Jello Biafra ran for mayor of San Francisco, one of his campaign promises was if elected, every businessman in the financial district would be required by law to wear a clown suit between 9 and 5 Monday to Friday.
Well, I mean, all you have to do is redefine what a clown suit is, right? If you just had all clowns wear a business suit, it'd accomplish the same thing, right?
I've heard a business suit called a clown suit, but yeah.
I thought it was a monkey suit or a gorilla suit
better.
Or something.
Yeah. So, Randy, do you wear...
Or is that a tuxedo?
Randy,
I don't know.
What do you wear in your lawyering?
Well, most of my lawyering that I do in my office at home is whatever I'm wearing around the house, you know, sweats or something like that.
Bathrobe.
But if you hire me and want me to go to court for you, I do put on the coat and tie.
If you pay me, I'll put on a tie. Yep.
I have to be paid to put on a tie, otherwise it does not happen.
Yeah. $75.
Is that like a legal obligation or a contempt of court thing? Like, if you showed up as an attorney into a courtroom in your pajamas, what happens?
No, there are exceptions. If you live in Texas or Arizona, they wave that in the summer. If you're a female, they wave it all the time. So, you know, but yeah, around here, it's still the standard uniform.
I don't think a lawyer really wants to think in terms of what I can wear to court and not get kicked out of the room. I think it's more about, like...
Well, you can't do that because you have to think about your client.
Right,
you know,
right.
you can't say, oh, it's okay if the judge gets mad at me as long as I don't get thrown out. You're always having to say, I can't afford to do anything that would reflect badly on the client. So you gotta do the game when somebody else's butt's on the line.
You got to bring enough corn chips for the whole class too.
Yes, yeah. Of course. It's the only decent thing to do.
So what do you guys think of this contract I sent?
Well, halfway down the second page, it looks like there's a kind of a spooky looking happy face in blood. That's weird. And then below it, another kind it. Of like, it's kind of like a ghost.
Yeah.
And then there's a little baby ghost or two down
holding
from
its
that.
Hand.
And
the whole ghost thing's holding its hands up. Yeah.
And all of that, yeah, in with the blood splatter and everything. The whole thing's creeping me out. So we should.
I think
talk
this is the kind of thing you have to frame
hour.
And put on the wall as a conversation
this
piece.
Can't be a good omen.
I don't know. I don't think my walls aren't as weird as they were back when I would have like immediately said, "All right, you guys take the next segment. I'm going to go send this to a framer or frame it." Yeah.
Well, just go to a thrift store and buy some cheap painting and then just rip it out and use the frame.
Yeah, but I don't cover my walls with weirdness anymore. The weirdness is all in my head now. I cover
your walls with blankets.
I cover my walls with little fake machine-made prayer rugs from Walmart.
There you go.
Yep. Because they soak up all the uncreamy radio audio ions. It's my space blanket for my voice.
Someday when we make a museum installation about you, we need this contract in there.
Okay. Yeah, and the, like, 55-pound server computer that we bought that we're going to use for Fiend Phone installed at the network.
Yep.
Yep. That used to be in a bank, and it kind of looks like a big safe deposit box. Worms. We'll be back for hour two of the Freedom Fiends after this trip to market. Hey, this is Michael Dean from the Freedom Fiends radio show. I've been working with computer programmer Derek Slopey to create Fiend Phone. I'm using Fiend Phone right now to talk with and record one of my co-hosts in real time. Take it, Davi.
Hey, this is Davi Barker, and I'm 1,000 miles away from Michael, but we sound like we're in the same room.
We sure do, Davi. So, Davi, please tell the nice people more about Fiend Phone.
Fiend Phone is free, open-source software that opens up a global world of possibilities for collaborative, high-quality remote voice media production, and I'm digging it.
People can try the Windows beta version of Fiend Phone right now at fiendphone.com. But we're also raising money to vastly improve Fiend Phone and vastly improve independent talk media worldwide.
So go to fiendphone.com and join the conversation, because if you don't, you'll set liberty back 2,500 years.
That's fiendphone.com. FENPHONE.com. Foxtrot, Echo, November, phone.com.
Fiend Phone. I never knew remote audio could be this good.
For those of you playing the home or game version of Fiend Phone along with the Freedom Fiends, I do want to point out that in the last segment, Randy was having some dropouts. Not the fault of Fiend Phone. I always say Fiend Phone should be run on a dedicated computer, and you don't need much of a computer to do that. And it's funny because like people balk at that idea. If Fiend Phone cost $200 and it ran on your computer with everything else running, they wouldn't question it. But if I say, here's a free program that's better than any other programs for doing voice over internet, but I suggest you buy a $100 used computer to exclusively run it on, they're like, that's crazy talk. But Randy's computer decided to do things. Like the time that Davi's computer decided to reboot and we lost him for part of a segment, what was your computer doing, Randy?
I'm not sure. I think maybe Windows and its wisdom had started to download an update or something.
Yeah.
Although it might have been my SkyDrive deciding to see if anything was out of sync with the cloud.
What's a SkyDrive? That sounds like some sort of like spaceship thing.
I'm shaking my fist at the sky. Damn you, cloud.
Actually, Microsoft has you can have so many. So
I don't
many
like the cloud
space in the cloud. Well, the cloud is you have to be careful how to use it But if you want things to be easily available from anywhere, sometimes you have to use the cloud. I mean, if I was going to leave the country, I would wipe my laptop. There wouldn't be a scrap of data on it. And I would get what I needed from the cloud after I
Yeah, but the cloud to me is just basically storing it on the NSA servers. I also want to be able to access my stuff when the internet's down someday.
It's not that I have something there that would get me arrested. It's that I have something there that could be stolen from me otherwise.
Or you have stuff that like is not illegal, but people at borders are so stupid that they'll think you have Bitcoin in your luggage like the TSA did when they detained Davi.
For the record, he means national borders, not the bookstore.
Is the bookstore even still around? You know what's funny?
I don't think that it is.
I am so blissfully unaware of like current events and news. Okay, here's a couple examples. I had no idea why people were talking about Brian Williams so much until I went and looked.
I still don't know. All I know is the memes, which are funny, but
I don't know. I was telling people that my books were available in all Borders bookstores until about somebody pointed out to me, you know that Borders went out of business 2 years ago. I'm like, oh, really? And I was saying that my DVDs were available at all Tower Records until somebody said, you know, they went out of business 9 months ago. Yeah.
You just need to keep up on your bankruptcies a little better.
I do. I have no idea. So I got a couple updates from last night. They're going to lead into talking about the art of writing for the rest of the show. First of all, we talked about my program Mouse Count that counts mouse clicks. I was going to link it in the show last night. I tried installing it, and it's really weird. Like, my antivirus program and the one that I recommend people use actually think it's a virus, even though it's not, because it uses an old method of accessing the Windows shell called a hook. And hooks are really commonly used. A Windows hook is really commonly used in viruses. So I didn't want to post something that was going to make everyone think I was posting a virus when I'm in the middle of like beta launching another software program. So I didn't put it there. And also, didn't Davi and I decide that measuring mouse clicks to charge people by instead of by the hour or by the job would actually be Marx's labor theory of value in action? We decided that after the show.
It has that ring to it. But you know what? So does measuring labor by time. I'm not really sure what an effective way to measure, like a honest sort of Austrian economic way of measuring a wage would be.
Yeah, I would like to get to the point in my life where people want the me component in something to the point where they just want to like pay for my, not my name, but like they were like, oh, well, let's get Michael Dean to do this and pay him the Michael Dean wage, you know, for the job.
Yeah. That's a good aspiration. I want that too, you know, like, because that's the thing, the most valuable thing that I have to contribute is my brain. Yep. And it could be 30 seconds worth of thinking or 8 hours worth of thinking, but like having, hopefully I'm able to produce something, some design, some slogan, some marketing campaign that's unique enough that it's me that's valuable to you, not my time, not my labor.
I mean, that's kind of...
Yes, but you are in time, though. You still have to deal with that.
I think that's kind of how ad agencies work, though. I know a little bit about major ad agency billing because I used to be a bike messenger before there was, email was a common thing. And I used to, like, deliver things in San Francisco from ad agencies to their clients, to their corporate clients. And, you know, often it was like a letter, you know, not an envelope, like a piece of paper. And I would just read them when I was in board in elevators. And it seems to me like largely the big agencies charge the big client by the job. And like the graphic arts is just kind of included. Like, you know, they'll spend, doesn't matter whether they come up with the words, just do it, and that's the whole ad campaign, or whether it's, you know, a complete rebranding with lots of graphics and movies and films and everything. And they probably do charge for the production of that art specifically. But, I mean, that's kind of ancillary to the whole thing. The whole thing is
just...
Well,
you guys do stuff for other people, don't you? Do you ever charge by the hour or by the job? Yeah. Or...
I do both.
Davi does more for other people than I do, but I have done a lot of work for other people, especially producing audio stuff and ads and things, but I'm not really a people person, and I end up really irking people a lot, so Davi's more employable than I am in that sense.
Well, I'm glad you've lasted so long on the radio, too.
I don't make money on the radio. That's a hobby, man.
Perhaps I'll send you a copy of Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People.
How to irk friends and pee off people. Yeah.
That's Dale Carnegie, not Andrew Carnegie.
Yeah. So
if you're Andrew Carnegie, you just buy them.
You just buy them.
Buy them as many friends as you need.
You buy them or force them out of business into the gutter. Okay, so I got sidetracked last night and didn't finish the story, and this will segue back into the writing thing. I was talking about Hubert Selby, and I said that Hubert Selby Jr., I said he changed everything, you know, in his 1965 book, I think 65 book, Last Exit to Brooklyn. It really changed not only, I got sidetracked on the trials that were over his book, the obscenity trial in America and the huge one in England that was a precedent-setting free speech thing. But what I set up and never finished was I said that he changed storytelling in America and in the world. And basically, his book, Last Exit to Brooklyn, have either of you read it or seen the movie?
No.
No, I haven't.
Have you guys seen The Wire?
I've only seen a couple episodes of The Wire. It's kind of on my list of things to do when I'm ready to binge watch something.
Yeah, it's great. The book Last Exit to Brooklyn, it's considered a novel, but it's actually like five short stories that are together. They're novel length, and they all take place in the same neighborhood, and they very slightly over intersect. Like the characters from one will be pop up in another one. And it's just about this neighborhood in Brooklyn, kind of the Red Hook district of Brooklyn, you know, in the late 50s, early 60s. And I mean, the characters were the kind of characters that had never really been written about by, you know, a major publisher's novel in America before, first of all. I mean, they are like, you know, families and sailors and like murderous, like gangs of violent tranny hookers who shoot speed and, you know, roll sailors and then have sex with each other and cross dressers and drug addicts. And it kind of like broke the mold for that kind of stuff to be able to be written about in America. You know, this mm-hmm. is before Bukowski was published. It was kind of concurrent with the Beatniks, but he never considered himself a Beatnik and he was never really included in all that. And Selby's actually huge in Europe, far more popular than he is in America. He's been translated into like, you know, 12 languages or something. And, you know, he wrote six or seven books, you know, like five novels and two collections of short stories. Two of his movies were made into great motion pictures. One is Last Exit to Brooklyn and one is Requiem for a Dream. And Last Exit to Brooklyn really kind of changed. Like it was before, you know, anybody ever cussed on TV or cussed much in movies. I mean, it influenced the template of a lot of like 70s filmmaking, like French Connection, you know, the really tough kind of cop drama, the down. I guess the only thing that'd really be a predecessor to it would be On the Waterfront with, what's his name? You know, Randy, right?
Marlon Brando?
Yeah, that guy. What's his name? I mean, that was kind of, that was in the same neighborhood actually and had kind of some of the same motifs, but it was still kind of like, it was gritty, but it was kind of cheesy, you know? It wasn't like the kind of filmmaking and writing that came later because of Selby. The direct influence that he had like on major things on TV was Richard Price was the guy who wrote the book Clockers, which was made into a movie that was very kind of underground, like New York, Brooklyn drug selling movie from the early 80s, kind of around the same time of those like Spike Lee, black filmmaker, you know, the kind of genre of like three brothers, one dies, one goes to prison and one changes his ways, like New Jack City. And Clockers kind of developed into The Wire. The Wire is very much like Clockers, and The Wire is very much like Last Exit to Brooklyn in the characters. I mean, even to the point where like there's a character named the Greek and there's a hangout coffee shop named the Greeks. I mean, there's homages to it. And, you know, without Selby, there wouldn't be that. And also CSI, Jerry Stahl, who was one of the main writers and kind of like wrote the template of what CSI was on the first four or five episodes. And Jerry Stahl and Richard Price are in my movie, Hubert Selby Jr., It'll Be Better Tomorrow. You couldn't really tell his story without interviewing those two guys, so we did. Jerry Stahl was incredibly influenced by Hubert Selby Jr. And he actually says, and they were friends, you know, he actually says something in the movie. He says that, you know, but when Jerry Stahl was writing his book, Permanent Midnight, which was made into a movie also, with Ben Stiller playing Jerry Stahl as a drug addict. You know, it's autobiographical. He was working on the movie, on the show Alf, as a screenwriter, and he was shooting heroin all the time. When he brought the draft of that book to Hubert Selby and showed it to him, he read it and he said, you know, you're a good writer, kid, but you got to make your characters likable. You have to make people care about them. And that's like the most valuable advice you could ever give a writer, is like, no matter how messed up a character is or a main character, like, you have to care what happens to them. And, you know, like he basically told Jerry Stahl that. And Jerry Stahl is, you know, multi-millionaire Hollywood screenwriter as a day job, but he's really a novelist. That's what he likes to do. So Selby was vastly influential on the art of storytelling in America, on particular storytelling in America, and what you can get away with in storytelling in America, and the gritty realism that is everywhere now. He built that, man. We'll be back.
Worms.
You're listening to The Freedom Fiends, an invigorating alternative to those other shows.
So, Zombie Barker, I mean, Davy Barker was giving away his trade secrets during the break.
Trade secrets during the break.
I was not taping, even though I am the libertarian NSA, according to Mark Edge. He says that because every time, he says I call into Free Talk Live every time my name's mentioned, which is absolutely not true. I'm not listening that often. I can't listen on Wednesdays anymore because, well, for reasons that cannot be named.
Never mind.
For reasons that cannot be named. We're weaning off of that. Yeah. So, but we're going to talk about writing and the craft of writing. And we all are writers. We all have books that are published. And so let's give our CVs starting from, and this is quantity, not quality. Let's start from least books written to most books written. Although I've written the most books and probably made the most money selling books, but I've probably done the least amount of literary work, less than you guys. Cause I've sold like $3 million retail worth of books, but, that's not my novel. My novel, I self-published 1,000 copies of and broke even on. So starting with Randy, what did you write? Where can we get it?
Well, you started with the oldest guy because, like, he might not live long enough to finish his story.
Finish your sentence.
So, yes.
Speak up, son.
Three books. I'm closer up to the microphone. Is that better?
Yeah, go ahead.
Anyway, three books. First one, 1989. It was a book that had to do with, I don't know if anybody remembers 1989 and the New Age movement, but it was about that.
Ew.
It spoiled me for every book that I did after that because I wrote it, I sent it to the first two publishers that might be interested in it, and both of them took it. I had to pick between them.
That's a quality problem.
I thought being a published author was the easiest thing in the world. Any fool could do it. And when one of them eventually went out of business, the other one picked it up. Then in 1999, 10 years later, I wrote a novel. Nobody would touch the thing. I self-published on paper without the internet. And then, of course, 2 years ago now, going on three, I wrote Free is Beautiful, which is my libertarian book, and did that all online, you know, with CreateSpace, self-published, and the whole thing is great because it still looks professional paperback. You've got the Kindle books. You've got the EPUB at Smashwords. It's really so easy now that if you've got a book and you'd like to be published, it doesn't even cost anything. I think for my last book, I spent like $4.50 twice so they could send me a proof copy so I'd make sure I was happy with it before I said go.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, Dobby.
And,
sorry, go ahead.
Anyway, three of them. The first one sold the most. You've sold about 10 times as much as me because I think I probably had maybe 300,000 in sales.
Well,
that was the hit.
$300,000 in sales or 300,000 units you sold?
No, dollars. About 30,000 in sales.
Oh, cool.
In the first book, and then fewer on the later ones.
Yeah, I've decided that I can no longer keep calling myself a professional writer because I haven't written a book in a long time. I don't plan to ever probably write a book again because I so much more love the craft of just yakking into a microphone every day. I was like, for the first few years I was a professional writer, the royalty checks I were getting, like when I would get my tax statements at the end of the year, were five figures. And that went on for a couple of years, and then they were four figures. And this year I looked at my tax statement and it was high three figures that I made this year. So I think I can't call myself a professional writer anymore. But
a familiar story, yes.
But it was fun. It was, you know, that's the reason that I can't like charge for the Michael Dean quotient, because I switch fields about every 5 years. So I don't really build enough in one. I get bored with something and move on to something else. And
well, Stephen Kuntz, who's a writer, he did Flight of the Intruder and a bunch of Navy novels and that. He has a website where he advises writers of fiction.
That sounds like horrible, and on the website, horrible work to do.
He said that there are fewer people in the United States that make their full-time living from writing, with the exception of technical writers or journalists, yeah. Leave them out of it. But there are fewer people make their full-time living writing than there are people in the U.S. Congress.
That sounds about right. So, Davi, what do you do?
So I'm going to include pre-internet stuff that I self-publish, and it's actually quite a bit. I hadn't even realized it, but the first thing that I published was a zine called Othilla. Othilla is the Norse rune for separation, and it was an autobiographical book of birth to my senior in high school about my general feeling of separation. Then I published the Jones Street Underpass, which was an anthology of short stories. In college, I published the Discordian Spelling Book, which is sort of a neo-pagan group of surrealist ritual.
Let's put a pin in there. Let's put a bookmark in this and do it when we come back from the break.
Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean. This is what radio sounds like now.
Hi, I'm Michael Dean from the Freedom Fiends. CryptoVape.net is a new company that sells tasty nicotine vape for Bitcoin. I've tried it. It's really good stuff, and they love Bitcoin. They have quality vape and a bunch of tasty flavors. CryptoVape.net. CryptoVape.net is a liberty-loving company, and if you mention the Freedom Fiends, they'll send you something cool with your order, free. CryptoVape.net. Great vapes, great price, and they love Bitcoin. CryptoVape.net. That's CryptoVape.net.
Time to try yet another political
I'm recording.
Well, that was my friend Lou there, wasn't it?
That is our friend Lou. I like Lou.
Me too. Lou's one of the few fiends that I've actually got to meet in person.
Yeah, you met him and you met Diana and who
Diana.
Else?
Diana. Well, I met Ben when he came through town. We spent an afternoon together just because he was in my part of the world.
Hey, any weekend you want to fly to Casper, I'll take you shooting and have dinner.
All right,
with
if I come through there, I will at least let you know. And if you're feeling in your grumpy old man mood, I won't have my feelings hurt if you
no,
avoid me.
I'd be psyched if you showed up, but I'd need a day or two notice. Davi has an open invitation to leave California and come live in my basement, and I wouldn't make that. I wouldn't make that offer to anybody else. He's the only one.
So they do have basements in Wyoming, though.
Yeah, our basement
I have trouble keeping track of which states have basements and which ones don't. You know, Texas
We have a 1,200-square-foot finished basement that the couple that owned this house before we did, the woman's mother and father lived down there. It's nice. It's nicer than most apartments.
When you were putting together your studio and you talk about how the house is brick and everything, how come you didn't go to the silence in the basement?
A couple reasons. One is because it's too like isolating down there for me. There's no windows. My windowless bunker actually has windows. My bedroom, but
you have a windowless bunker in the basement. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it has windows too, but I've covered them completely so I can sleep down there. If like the neighbor kids are being loud, I can go down and just take a nap. But why don't I go down there? The other is getting internet down there would be hard. I'd have to drill holes in the floor and run a cable down. Also, I'd have to run cables down and run to the front of the house. I think I'd have to buy a new refrigerator, actually, to make that work. Because our refrigerator is getting old, and it kind of like it kind of makes noise. Like, it's not that loud up here, but if you're under it in the basement, it kind of amplifies it, like the floor, the ceiling of the
sounds like too much work.
Acts like a resonator.
And you're right. Moving to the basement would make your seasonal affective disorder go over the top, you know?
I'm already twisted and unusual enough not leaving the house much and sleeping in the daytime. I would become a troll if I moved this down to the basement.
Yeah, and internet people that do podcasts and stuff really don't want to go with the typecast, you know, broadcasting from the basement sort of thing.
Yep.
For the record, I'm not in the basement either.
Good. Although are you on the second floor or the first floor?
We only have a first floor and a basement.
Ah.
But I'm on the opposite end of the house where my wife is.
I won't say it because we're recording, but I like the names of the street corner you live on.
I don't live on a street corner.
Wait a minute. Let me stop recording. Locations. Keep your anonymity. Okay, I'm recording now.
Well, as it is, my street name simply mocks me, Michael. Yes. What can I say?
I think you should get on the town council and tell them it's too statist and they need to change it. You should work from within the system.
Yes, well, our town council right now is trying to figure out whether they're going to continue to tell us who our garbage man will be. It's very important work. And actually, there's one council person, there's six people running for mayor, and one of them says they want to get rid of the mandatory trash pickup, where you have to pay for it whether you use it or not. And I don't really care for this person, but I'm almost angry enough about it, but not quite enough to actually go and vote when the time
comes. In a libertarian paradise, who would pick up your trash would be whoever would do it the best for the least price.
You know, if the city stopped picking up your trash, you know, mandatorily, there'd be three people putting flyers on my front door saying, please let me pick up your trash, and it would be less than what I'm paying.
Okay, back a half inch off the mic. You know, they always say, like, without the government, the trash would pile in the street. In the most statist city I've ever lived in, probably Los Angeles, like, you actually, the trash is picked up privately, or in Los Angeles County outside of L.A. You have a choice. It has to be from a, you know, list of vendors, but it's private. Here we go. Yeah. We'd like to welcome our new affiliate, WPNN in Pensacola, Florida. That is a great thing. WPNN 790 AM. Good folks. I've talked to them a bunch. And that brings our affiliate list up to 35 stations. And that is definitely something to celebrate. The Freedom Fiends are on 35 stations. You know, really, I'm surprised we're on any stations. Not because we're not good, but because we're kind of weird. We're kind of not like most of the other shows, except for Free Talk Live, but we're different from them in a lot of ways, too. There aren't many shows that talk about true liberty, but we're really not talking politics tonight or anything like that. I do just want to say that Barack Obama is a liar. He's a socialist and his feet stink. We try to say that at least once an hour if we're not talking about politics. We're talking about the craft of writing. So, Davi Barker, you were in the middle of your bibliography of published books. Jump in where you were.
Yeah, so when I was in college, I did two student projects. One was 13 issues of a monthly magazine called E Prime that was sort of student surrealist, I suppose, articles or journalism or something. But it was things like, you know, if an infinite number of monkeys typed on an infinite number of typewriters, one of them would eventually write an advice column. And so our advice column was called Ask an Ape, stuff like that. I also did a poetry anthology of student work called Please Recycle, which was my sort of lefty Marxist take on Steal This
Ew.
Book.
That's funny, though.
And then
you've always liked the surreal, I must say.
I have always sort of been a surrealist.
Goes back to your pagan days, doesn't it?
Ew. It does, yeah.
Well, I think you're missing one of your publishing things that wasn't actually publishing. But what did you do with the bus maps in San Francisco?
Oh, yeah. So it used to be that it's Valley Transit Authority is the Bay Area bus system. And it used to be that the maps that they had on the bus were black and white. And so I scanned one, brought it into Quark, made a sort of dummy schedule and replaced it with sort of surrealist sort of articles and things and called it things like the Vehicular Taoist Association or the Vikings for a Totalitarian America or things like that. And I essentially made fake schedules and then loaded them into the schedule holsters on all the buses. So I would get on a bus, I'd swap out all the schedules, I'd get off, and then I'd wait for the next bus. And within a month of me doing this on a semi-regular basis, they converted to full-color schedules. And I think it was to price me out of doing it.
It was. Were the schedules still usable the way you made them?
No, but I made sure that the real ones were still available.
Oh, okay. Good. All right. So,
because usually they didn't fill their whole rack, right? So I would fill up empty space or sort of space them out. So I was taking up about half the rack.
Yep. The other books.
So most of that stuff isn't available anymore. And maybe it's worth going through and seeing if any of it is worth editing and publishing.
Scan it.
But the stuff that's available now is my first, I guess, published book is called Voluntary Islam, which is an anthology of essays about both Islam and libertarianism and where they overlap and where they need to overlap more, I think.
It's a good book. I read it.
Thank you. After that is Authoritarian Sociopathy, which is a look at a number of psychological experiments on power and authority, not just Milgram and Stanford Prison Experiment, but like five or six that have been done since then that people don't know about. And then also a proposal for an experiment that I think should be done on police brutality, specifically on people's willingness to intervene in an instance of police brutality. And then my most recent book is Survivor Max, which is fiction, and it's about an 11-year-old boy surviving in the zombie apocalypse by himself.
Excellent. And I gotta have any of us read each other's books other than that one, The Voluntary Islam, that Randy has read?
I did. I read that, not your current book, but the one between that and Voluntary Islam.
You ever read any of my books?
About the Milford experiment and that. It was good.
Milgram.
But I kind of knew about some of that stuff already. But if you don't, it would be good to read.
Yeah. I think I'm getting at the point of, like, I don't think we're friends and colleagues and coworkers, but we haven't read a lot of each other's books, probably because we're too busy, like, making more media. And
yeah, I don't spend a lot of time reading, unfortunately. Yeah. But, I mean, on my list of books to read is The Handbook for the Human Experience. That's the one of all the ones you talk about that I'm most interested
in. That's the most
book. I read most of that one, Michael.
That's the book that I'm, like, most interested in still promoting to people. So my first book was called Starving in the Company of Beautiful Women. It was a novel, kind of like
Bukowski.
Yeah, it's kind of like Bukowski with heroin. And it was back in my bad old punk rock days before, you know, thank God I don't have to do that anymore kind of stuff. And that book was self-published, you know, like Randy said, before the internet. Like, I went to a printer to do it, pressed 1,000 copies of it. It's very out of print. You can buy it on Amazon used for sometimes for like 50 cents and sometimes for like $180, depending on who's selling it. You can grab a PDF of that off of the Freedom Fiends torrent feed. And then I wrote three books that were a trilogy for a tech publishing company, but they were kind of like tech books with a lot of personal asides in them. They weren't just, you know, screenshots. $30 Film School, $30 Music School, and $30 Writing School. And those are the three that have sold the most copies, you know, altogether $3 million retail. Those books kind of taught me, writing those books kind of taught me to do tech writing and tech descriptions, which Davi says I still do in everything I do. Like, I try to explain everything in kind of a how-to fashion for like a beginner as well as an intermediate audience at the same time. Like, you know, if I'm saying like how to install the Fiend phone, I'll include like, okay, here's how to make a shortcut for it on the desktop. And most people know that, but some people don't. So I always explain every step in it. Then I wrote a book called The Simple Pleasures of a Complex Girl, which was fiction, my lowest selling book. It was self-published on Cafe Press or something, probably sold 40 copies. And then I was paid not to write a book. There's this book called DIY Now, Digital Audio. And it's kind of funny because if you actually search that title on Amazon, it's still listed as available from some booksellers. Because the way publishers work with tech books is they actually list them and start taking orders for them before they're finished. But it was for Peach Pit Press, I think it was one of those big tech companies. And while, like, we were paid to write it, and it was myself and I got a couple other people to help write it with me. And during the writing of it, you know, and the way it works with tech books and with most advances is you don't get it all at once because they're sick of writers like putting the advance up their nose and never turning in the book. So they pay you a quarter upon signing, a quarter when it's halfway done, a quarter when it's done, and then a quarter after you've gone through all of the tech rewrites and editorial rewrites. And we got two of those advances. And then when it was time for the third one, the company had restructured. They'd fired the editor who'd greenlit the book, and basically were going to lock it up forever. They were like not going to pay us the rest of it and not going to let us release it with anybody else. And my agent, at my request, got them to basically let us keep the money and publish it ourselves. And we ended up publishing it online. So that was kind of interesting. It was kind of like the private version of, you know, paying farmers not to produce grain, but then letting them sell it out the back door to somebody else. And
which to keep other books more valuable, right? That's the reason.
Yeah, increase the
quality. Government should pay people to burn books. That would have kept borders in business.
I think governments have paid people to burn books throughout history. All right, and then I co-wrote a book called for O'Reilly Media, called YouTube: An Insider's Guide to Climbing the Charts, with this guy Alan Lustofka, who's kind of one of the first like 10 or 15 people who went viral on YouTube and was making a living at it. And I was a friend of his, and I suggested, hey, why don't we write this book? And I got a book deal with O'Reilly through my agent. And basically, like, they kept me on the project as a credited ghostwriter. Like, he was the YouTube expert, but he'd never written a book. And I knew how to write a book and work with a tech author. So I got paid to be the tech helper on that. And then I wrote a chapter in a book called Digital Video Hacks for O'Reilly. And I was the editor on a book called DV Filmmaking from Start to Finish by O'Reilly, and then wrote a couple sections in Make Magazine, which is also connected with O'Reilly. So yeah, I've done a bunch of tech stuff and haven't done it in a while, and I'm going to quit calling myself a professional writer now that I've gotten my tax statement for this year and see how little I actually made last year. It was in the high three figures. So I think I can hang up that hat, but I'm not really interested in it anymore. But I'm interested in the process of writing and as a creative thing, because it also enters into spoken media, like how we do a show, how we try to have three-act format in it and conclude things we say. And if we made a mistake the day before, we correct it the next day. If we started a story and never finished it the day before, we point it out the next day. We like it to be kind of complete. So guys, talk about your process a little bit, please. Thank you.
The process.
Speak up, son.
Of writing?
Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't figured out what mine is yet. I do make an outline when I'm writing nonfiction. When I wrote my novel, I just wrote the thing, and everything that happened was as much a surprise to me as it would have been to the reader, and that's weird.
I think the analogy would be in filmmaking.
No, I have that experience for sure.
In filmmaking,
yeah. Well, I didn't understand it till I did it.
They say that a document or a drama film is directed for a second time in the editing, and they say that a documentary is directed for the first time in the editing. Like, when you're making a documentary film, you don't know all the footage you're going to have until you film some of it. You make an outline for anything you do, but you know, you film some interviews, you put it into a timeline, you kind of in a rough timeline, and you look at it and watch it, and you're like, okay, there's something missing in the story here. What are we going to put to fill that in? It kind of, I think that kind of works the same with fiction versus nonfiction writing.
Yeah, but
for me,
go ahead, Dobby.
For me, it's about the number of hamsters in my brain. For nonfiction, I have one hamster in my brain, and it's this little socialist that I keep around to argue with. And I argue with it for a little while, and then once I'm convinced that I've defeated it, it's sort of like playing chess with yourself, right? You're your hardest opponent. Then I write down the way the argument went. For fiction, I give a hamster to every character, and I sort of give them some free will. And I see how they interact. And I sort of have these like long imaginative processes of sort of just watching them interact or trying to come up with interesting or fun ways to that they might interact. And I'll write it down, right? And so I will sort of outline. What I really do is I write it down on like 3x5 cards and I shuffle them into the order I think they should happen in the story. But there's scenes like I just know this character and this character need a scene where this happens. And I don't know where it's going to fit, but it's going to fit somewhere.
I love the hamster description, man. We'll be back for the redemption in the third act on the Freedom Fiends On Writing, Volume 2.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and some of his weird friends. And yes, we're broadcasting this into space.
Is your child defiant, independent, annoyingly inquisitive? After a long, hard day of following the rules, who wants to deal with troublesome kids? 49% of children suffer from oppositional defiant disorder, or ODD. Symptoms of ODD include independent thought, rampant creativity, and failure to submit to authority. But now there's a solution. The good people at Pilfer can help you with their time-release, once-daily capsule, Compliacin. Your child won't be able to form his own opinions, let alone express them. It maintains your child's ability to go to a state-run school and perform simple tasks around the house. You won't have to worry about parenting, and the school won't have to deal with your kid asking questions. Compliacin. You'll go from this. To this.
Good morning, Mother. I love going to school. And this week we're learning all about how the government is our federal family and they're here to help us.
Compliacin. Talk to your school psychiatrist and ask for it by name.
I carry them around. You know what I mean?
Now, Michael, you have a lot more weird friends than you knew now that you know how many hamsters in Dobby's brain.
Like, I'll give you an example. In Survivor Max 1, there's a whole thing where he escapes a herd by hiding in a caged gardening truck, right? I don't know if you've ever seen professional gardeners, but they have those big trucks with the cages on the back.
Yeah.
I was going to the post office and I went by a gardener, and like, because I was carrying Max around in my brain, it jumped out at me like, oh, that's a good,
It's an all consuming thing. Like, I do know, especially when writing a novel more than when writing nonfiction, like the characters become, they're in your dreams, they're in your daily life, you know, you're out and about and you're like, what would this character do in this situation?
Should we save this for the show?
I'm recording. So,
oh, okay. I was going to ask Davi. You were talking earlier about Brian. What's his name? Who's the guy got in trouble on TV? Brian Williams. And you mentioned the memes, and somebody just sent me what I think is the best meme I've seen. It's the picture of him sitting at the anchor desk, and he's saying, "So there we were at this bridge, and Frodo says to me, 'Here, you take the ring.'" I don't know. It was a good one.
Yeah, I'm looking at one. It says, "So here we were. So there we were at the computer, and Satoshi Nakamoto says to me, 'Here, you compile it.'"
and here's another story with him. It says, "NBC's Brian Williams drops claims to have been personally beheaded by Al Qaeda." I have to read more of these. They're all a riot, you know.
That's something, I don't know what the controversy is. Like, okay, mainstream media news anchor lies. Like, this is not news for me.
Yeah, it's not.
No. It's caught lying. No, he admits lying.
Oh.
That's the story.
Have you guys ever found a good anagram for your names? I found one for mine.
Redbird Kava.
Ah. Mine is
deal. It's a brand of coffee, I guess. I don't know.
Mine is deal.
Kava's a drug. It's a sedative.
I know. Mine is deal machine.
Yeah, my name is nerdy or something like that, is it? I haven't really set to work at that task.
I like deal machine. Kind of fits.
Although Redbird Kava doesn't work anymore because I took the D out of David. I'm going to come up with another one.
Hey, can you guys send me emails right after the show of the page that would have all your books on it?
Yeah, probably Amazon would.
Sure.
I guess. Let me see what comes
up. Do you have a page on your website that links all the Amazon links?
Yeah, I got one.
Yeah, I think I do.
It'll be coming here. I think it's going to be the about page on my blog or something.
Yeah. Mine's going to be the bio on the Freedom Fiend site, because I could send people to the O'Reilly page, but it has all my Amazon links in the. They have their Amazon links on the O'Reilly page. Oh no, wait! I edited these. These are my Amazon links. Let me see.
This doesn't have authoritarian sociopathy on it, but it has early drafts of books in progress.
That doesn't work as well. So, what are we going to do for the redemption in the third act about writing? Talk more about the process, I think.
I don't know. I asked you yesterday if you thought being a musician influenced your writing style, and you said no, but I was going to say absolutely yes. Like, there's a lot of things that I learned about lyrics and poetry that
probably,
you know, they're part of my rules in prose writing, right? And it has to do with how concise I'm trying to be, or one of the rules of medieval poetry is that it has to be memorized. That used to be the dividing line, that something memorized was a poem and something not memorized was a prose. And that was why poems tended to rhyme, was because it made them easy to remember.
And they were shorter. unless they're epic poems.
And they were shorter, yeah.
There's people that can recite epic poems, though.
Yeah, for sure. But that was a part of it for me, was like a lot of times, like my tendency to forget was part of my editorial process. Like if the line was remembered, that meant that it was good enough to include.
So, everyone here has been a musician for a long time in their life. Is that right?
Yeah. Selby was influenced
not very successfully.
Selby was influenced by jazz.
I never made much money at it.
I made some money at it for a while.
Yeah, I know. Michael's definitely the
couple years. Here we go.
The pro.
Here we go. Freedom Fiends. So we're talking about the process of writing. We were talking during the break about how Hubert Selby said that, and people said of him, that his writing was influenced by jazz music, including the fact that in several of his novels, the tabs at the beginning of a paragraph are different lengths. And that's indicating the silence that he wanted, you know, like pause before you read the next part to kind of give it a more of a planned lyricism. And
that's cool.
Yeah. So Davi asked if my writing was influenced by having been in a band. And I said, not consciously or specifically, but definitely like the way I approach it commercially and non-commercially and my drive with it and my kind of like do things. It was interesting writing the $30 music school book and the $30 writing school book, because it was the first books I'd ever written that I knew were going to be published when they were done. And that was a very like freeing, but also kind of frightening thing. And I always made music like not knowing it was going to be published, you know, not knowing the one record we did at Warner Brothers that I knew was going to have a label for it, 'cause we had the contracts and, you know, we were signed. You know, we would always like write the music and make the recording and then find a label to put it out. And that was the one where, you know, there was somebody already going to put it out, but the songs were already written too. So I always approached things in music in a way that has taught me with writing and with radio, you know, with podcasting, like make the art that you want to make and then try to find the audience for it and try to find the delivery mechanism of the audience for it. And I will say that, you know, I grew up in the punk rock scene of like, it was kind of required that you hated major labels. It was part of the thing. And I've also found that most artists who say they hate major labels will jump at the chance to sign to them. It's kind of like libertarians who say, oh man, the government's so square, I hate the government. Like, that's easy to say all day long. And then you see libertarians like running to the government guns when the going gets tough. And
they take their Social Security when the time comes.
That's not okay. That's a whole other argument. And I don't think that's a violation because you paid into it.
But I'm taking mine.
I'm talking about using, yeah,
not yet.
I would too, but I haven't paid enough into it to probably get much because I've always been an independent contractor for most of my life.
You need 40 quarters. Yeah, 40 quarters
I've,
of
I've
income.
I've not done that. So I've always, like, my thing has always been like, you know, make the art you're going to make and then go to Moses on the mountain to bring it to the audience. And I've actually, I guess this is the thing I found that influenced me from music into writing with the process too, is that I've never shied away from dealing with corporations, because here's my experience. Like, I was on a bunch of punk rock record labels that were run by people who love music, only sign bands they like. Those people tend to go out of business owing you money. And that's happened to me a bunch. And the people, like, you know, the Warner Brothers, you know, who don't care about music at all. They just look at it like soap. It's like a product, you know? They pay what they say they're going to pay you, and they don't say they're going to pay you much, but they pay what, you know, corporations don't generally pay their bills. The labor of love, independent labels and publishers tend to go out of business, not paying their bills.
I had that happen to me.
With what?
Well, my first book, the first publisher went out of business.
Yep.
And sold out, or one of them did, second one. Second one sold out.
Dutch East India Trading Company, not the original one, but the record distributor named after that, went out of business owing me for 100 copies of my band's first record to Elvis in Hell. So there. If anyone's listening that still runs that company, you owe me money, man.
Funny thing, the first one I had went out of the business of doing that and sold it to another one. And the guy called me up. He was good about it. He said, look, I owe you this much money, and I have about this much inventory of your book. Can I pay you with that?
That's nice. That's
and more he sent than it most to me. Do. And a week later, the new publisher called me up and said, it's going to take us a while to gear up and get some of your books printed. Would you have any you could sell me?
Yeah.
I said, I'm sorry, I already took them off the truck, but they'll be back on one tomorrow.
Yeah. I had a similar experience like that with my first movie that I got distribution for, DIY or Die, How to Survive as an Independent Artist. I actually paid to have like 300 VHS copies of it made up and then got a deal for it. And I was starving, and fortunately, like, the people who picked it up for DVD actually, like, bought all of the remaining VHS copies of it from me. It was good.
Sometimes it works.
Got a quick one, Davi?
I guess the closest thing I can think of is, as the editor of Daily Anarchist, at one point there was some debt that accrued to me, and I was paid off in merchandise, and that's where Shiny Badges came from.
Nice. So it all works out. Sometimes the sad days become the happy days if you play your cards right and if fate smiles on you. Worms, guys. Great show.
Worms, guys.